Welcome to Book Waves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Shalom Auslander, who has a novel, Hope, a Tragedy, earlier books, a memoir, Foreskin's Lament, and Beware of God Stories. Shalom Auslander grew up in Muncie, New York, in a very, very religious Orthodox community, almost a shtetl in the woods, which was quite different than someone growing up, say, in a religious household in a big city, because it was more cultish. Is that correct?
Yeah, very insulated and very strange and not at all functional. Yeah, fiddler in the woods.
When you were growing up, fairly early on, you must have realized that something was a little bit off. Your father drank too much. The religious laws made weekends unbearable.
Yeah, and his abuse of kosher wine wasn't helping. You know, the truth is that because it was so cultish, it's so insulated, I thought there was something wrong with me, not wrong with it, because no one else seemed to have a problem with it. The reality was that however bad my father was, that was what men were like. The rabbis could be vicious. God was much more vicious. So it didn't seem it was all out of whack, other than that I thought, what's wrong with me? Why am I interested in what's on the other side of the fence?
But you knew there was an outside world, you know.
But even within the outside world, you bring your makeshift ghetto walls with you. So you're at the pool, but everyone else is having cookouts and eating at the snack shack, and you've got your apples and matzah with butter on it. And there was just something that was much more compelling to me. And maybe it was just because at that age I was curious, and also it hurt so much for me to be in that Skinner box of the Lord that I had to get out.
And as you were growing up, did you watch much television, see movies, read? Because I know that in looking on your website and reading a number of your essays, you're very well read at this point. But it sounds as if you may not have started until fairly late. Or were you sneaking away to read Catch-22 when you were 12?
I'd have been happier if I was. I read a lot. For me, books were the one outlet. I lived at the library. I was very proud when at like 9 years old they gave me the adult library card and I could go in and take out 15 books at a time and just pour through them. It wasn't fiction or philosophy at that point. No, TV was not allowed. We had televisions in the house, but you were not supposed to be watching. In the first school I went to, TV was a tool of Satan, so you're not supposed to have it.
I don't remember Satan in my Hebrew school.
Yeah, Satan. He's the evil tempter. He came out as the snake in the apple tree. He's that character who tries to get you off the path. One of like the great early hypocrisies of my life, you were not supposed to have a television in the house. But in 1979, when ABC put out a miniseries called The Holocaust, somehow they also made it a rule that you had to watch. All 9 hours of it, or whatever it was endless. I don't think I've ever watched Meryl Streep ever again. She was the wife, the German wife of the poor Jewish artist.
Did your community have a specific name for what you guys called yourself, or just Orthodox Jews?
They just called it that. I mean, there's a thousand different, they're like street gangs, and everyone has their name. But that was all. It wasn't Hasidic. It wasn't even considered ultra-Orthodox, although it was, probably they called it yeshivish, which is, you know, yeshiva is a school, and it's your whole world is centered around that.
You wore payas with crew cut and...
When I was very young, I had payas. I wasn't good at them. And I tended to leave my yarmulke in the yard. It only occurs to me now. I wonder if that was some sort of early indication of what was to come. My father was always yelling at me because he'd go out and find yarmulkes all over the yard. But yeah, it was serious. Some people were raised with it and loved it. Just wasn't in the cards for me.
Your books are very, very funny. Were you a comedian around school? I mean, did you try to crack kids up?
No, I was very angry for the most part. And, you know, comedy and humor is anger, and so it became that later. I mostly used humor around the family to stop them from trying to kill each other. Because of that, didn't really like it. It wasn't until later that, as a teenager, that I discovered some authors and comedians and people that were using humor in a very, very specific way that I fell in love with as a weapon.
Who were they?
We didn't learn very much literature, as you can imagine, but when I found Kafka and Beckett, and these were just in bookstores, or Heller, it was like a revelation. It was like, wow, these guys, I was shocked when I found out later in life that people took them seriously. I couldn't believe that, you know, anyone would read Flannery O'Connor and not think that was funny. This woman's just nuts, and she's totally acting out. And so at the same time as I was reading all that stuff, we had, you know, pirated cassette tapes of Eddie Murphy, Lenny Bruce, later on Bill Hicks. It was early days of National Lampoon as well, which was just brilliant at that time. And so to this day, Mike O'Donoghue, who was one of the founding writers there, is something of a hero to me. So it all became, wow, you can use this stuff. This stuff is powerful. And I remember reading, you know, this quote from Twain, I think it was, that against the assault of humor, nothing can stand. And it's an amazing thing. And it's, for me, it's both a survival mechanism and a weapon.
What about the Jewish writers who used humor, like Philip Roth?
The first Jewish writer I read was Leonard Michels, and didn't really want to read Jewish writers after that. I wasn't even aware that Kafka was when I was reading him, except I had neighbors named Kafka, and I thought maybe they're related. But I didn't want to read them. You know, Heller wasn't writing about that stuff, and it was an odd thing to make a difference, to matter. So I didn't even care. I was trying to expand my world. I didn't want to break out of prison and then read books about life in prison. So I just never really read them. Although, you know, having said that, everything I liked, I assumed was Jewish. So I thought Charlie Brown was Jewish. I thought Bugs Bunny was Jewish. I thought Beckett was Jewish. So I avoided everything that was Jewish, but then somehow if I liked it and thought it was funny, I just assumed they were.
Well, because I guess all of that was science fiction and fantasy, you didn't need to read science fiction and fantasy.
Yeah, or horror.
How about Woody Allen? When did you discover him?
Woody Allen was, in the community I came from, a hated person. You would think, wow, famous Jewish guy. Well, they hated him. He was self-hating and an embarrassment. So that only made me want to listen to him even more. And the first things I saw of his, though, were the early films, Take the Money and Run and all that. And then after seeing that, went off and looked for his stand-up. And it seemed like the stuff I'd been reading. It seemed like Beckett was taking heavy subjects and messing with them, mostly because you're trying to find an answer within them, but you're smart enough to know there probably isn't one.
Shalom Auslander, according to Foreskin's Lament, you tried for a while writing stories, but you kept tearing them up. They just weren't quite good enough. Were those stories funny, or were you trying to be serious, or what?
I think that was the problem. I thought that you had to be serious. I don't know why I would have thought that, because I never read people who were serious. I think what happened was I'd read all these people. They were very sort of formative and just eye-opening to me. This is what I want to do. And then I sat down to do it, but by that time I'd been reading the people who write about those people. And literature is very religious, unfortunately. There's a lot of zealotry. There are the prophets and the books that are holy, and I think that threw me off. But I have a tendency to be very serious. I have a dark, you know, there's dark humor, but there's also this tendency to go be serious. So what happens is, like one of the stories in Beware of God is about a monkey that gets sudden consciousness and naturally gets very depressed, tries to paint, and then kills himself, which is what would happen if, you know, if you just got consciousness one day. But when that started, I was like convinced it's like 800-page mega novel, like doorstop. Kind of, wow, this is, you know, someone call the Pulitzer people. And I have to kind of get sick of myself and sick of that heaviness and then just go, there's something in here if I just let it be.
And at what point did you realize, well, wait a second, you know, a monkey gaining consciousness, getting depressed is going to be funny?
I think I resisted that. And again, there's also, you know, some of the filmmakers like Kubrick and stuff were also very, very inspiring to me, more so than Monty Python, who I thought was brilliant, but they were trying to be funny, whereas in, like, Strangelove, it's played dead straight, and it's funny because you're gasping. And so I wanted to do that, and so I thought the way to do that was to just approach it seriously, when the reality is it's just, it is what it is. And once I let it be that and said, okay, well, you know what? Maybe you won't be that serious brooding writer that you don't read anyway, and maybe you'll just go have some fun for the rest of your life.
Which in another sense could be said that you were finding your voice.
Yeah. Do you look at a picture of, say, Rashi or Maimonides, these great Jewish spiritualists, and then look at a picture of Dostoevsky, and it's they're dead ringers for each other. They sit there with their head in their hands, and they've got long beards, and like, why do I don't want to stick around with this. And besides, Crime and Punishment's a hilarious idea.
Well, if Crime and Punishment is a hilarious idea, what about the Talmud?
Yeah, it's just, you know, what is it, like 100 volumes of people arguing and never reaching any answers about anything. It's Proustian.
Are there really over 600 things to watch out for every day?
There are 613. In fact, there was a children's album that they played for me called 613 Torah Avenue. And, yeah, it's a combination of 200-something plus 300-something positive commandments, like do this and that, and then negative, don't do this, don't do that.
And you spend your whole life doing this, and you don't really ask why, because God, or as you call him, Frank, is going to get really angry.
Well, you know what? You know, when Tony Soprano says to do something, you do it. You don't ask why. And, you know, he's a mob boss, and he's unhinged, and he's done some crazy, crazy things in the past. So you don't ask why.
At what point in your mind was the real escape? You went to Israel after shoplifting, and you wound up living in the city and, you know, hanging out and doing drugs and stuff. But was there a certain point where you suddenly walked away and said, forget this noise? And at what point and how did your writing change at that point?
I actually think that it was something that was always there. You know, I actually point to the earliest moment of turning on a light on Sabbath just to see what would happen, just to see if I would get struck dead, as probably the most important, that first step, that first question mark. Everything else follows from that. They became bigger questions, or then I became more frightened and ran back to religion, depending on who was, you know, which grandparent was dying or what hockey team was losing, and I'd just try and appease it in that way. I think once I started to write about those stories, that was what made me realize that I'm probably insane, but there are a lot of people with that same insanity, and that changed everything for me. To be able to be the fool in the story as an author or a character and then laugh at it is a critical element that I don't think I had when I was still suffering under all of that.
Well, you were always able, I guess, in your writing at least, to put aside, you know, the kind of questions like, you know, other people are going to know me from my writing. To open oneself up like that is a huge step, particularly when you're coming from a world where nobody opens themselves up.
Yeah, and you know, maybe that's why. If everything is dark and secretive, then I just want to throw all the windows open. Because there's nothing to be concerned about. Underneath it all, we're all that way. We're all, you know, we're all pathetic and weird and do strange things with our genitals and wake up in the middle of the night worried about bizarre things, and that's who we are. So I kind of feel like that's what was so missing from my life.
Well, I think in Foreskin's Lament, there must have been a certain shock of recognition when you discovered that your father read porn.
Well, I knew that from a very early stage, yeah, because it was his that I was stealing. That's perfectly normal. There's not, you know, the funny thing with that is that that doesn't make him a bad guy. It makes him a guy.
It makes him a hypocrite, too.
Yeah, but it makes him a human being. The problem is that you're not supposed to be a human being. It isn't the having it, it's the hiding it. And so that became something for me that I just didn't want to have to do. I didn't want to have to hide everything.
Shalom Auslander, in Foreskin's Lament, before we get on to Hope a Tragedy, in Foreskin's Lament, your brother is the bad kid, and he's constantly being criticized by your parents, yet in the end he drank the Kool-Aid.
In the end he stayed. It was his decision. It effectively meant, though, that we weren't going to be able to have a relationship. And I don't know that in the kind of family I came from, that was ever a solid relationship anyway, because everyone's just trying to survive, and survival's ugly, which isn't a bad segue into Hope a Tragedy. But, yeah, I don't have any contact with any of them because of that.
No contact at all?
No.
Do you get secondhand information about what they think of your writing?
I don't think I need that. I think I can guess. It ain't Talmud.
Do you regret no contact?
No, not for a second. The very first thing a shrink ever said to me was that I have a very unfortunate streak of optimism that keeps getting me hurt. that optimism kept me in the family longer than I should have been. This, oh, no, but if I just do this, everything will be okay. And in large part, that's why I decided for Hope, that I liked having the idea of a character whose flaw was Hope.
And that brings us to Hope, a Tragedy. Had a book like that been in your mind from the beginning, or at what point did you realize that your first novel would kind of look at the relationship of the Jewish religion and hope and the Holocaust?
Well, to me, the book is about dealing with the past. For my specific issues, it's the Holocaust. It came out of having two sons and being a fairly bleak guy and not wanting to turn them into it and beginning to ask myself, so, okay, so what do I tell them? My views on life are fairly well formed, and I'm pretty sure I don't want them to have it. The people I look to for answers, like Beckett and Kafka, never had kids, so they never had to deal with this question. So for me, it was all about writing something about someone trying to get away from the past, a historical past and a family past, and failing to do so because you can't really.
And that came after Foreskin's Lament, because in Foreskin's Lament, it's about the birth of your first child.
Right.
So there was a period in there where you were doing This American Life, writing essays, and figuring out what your novel would be?
Well, yeah. What happened was I always thought if I can write my way out of religion, things are going to be very, very happy for me. That did not prove to be the case, because what ended up happening was my older son, he was about 5 at the time, got very ill, got swine flu, and became very sick, and it was very frightening time. I found myself sitting on the steps of Albany Medical Center trying really hard to curse God, to just hate him, and finding that I didn't believe him anymore. And I missed having someone to hate and blame for all of it. And in the absence of that, the only thing you can sort of blame is life itself, is the universe itself. If God isn't commanding people to go to war, then it's just people wanting to. If God isn't punishing you with disease, it's just, this is kind of a crappy place. It doesn't work out the way we want it to all the time. And so I wanted to kind of deal with that. Now what? If I get rid of God and it doesn't solve anything, what do I do about people? So if Foreskin's Lament is trying to deal with the unfortunate reality of a God for me, Hope, a Tragedy is very much about trying to make peace with the idea of mankind.
I notice, though, that there's a tendency when talking about God, the Hebrew word, you'll still use Hashem because you're not supposed to say the actual word.
Right.
Do you still feel that way?
It's just a force of habit. I was raised that way, so I find myself, if someone says, if I'm talking about Sabbath, that I'm working to say Sabbath and not Shabbos. It just doesn't compute.
Well, what happens with me, of course, is when I see that in a book, it's like watching a movie and someone gives a phone number and it begins 555. It's like, okay, we're in fiction world now.
Right, yeah, I know. And should it ever get adapted into another form, that's part of the challenge, is not turning it into, you know, some horrible Hollywood yidle-didle, this is what people in Brooklyn act like, and it's always terribly wrong, and they're saying the wrong things, and their beards are too perfectly trimmed.
You're listening to an interview with Shalom Auslander, whose latest book is a novel, Hope, a Tragedy. The book concerns, and it kind of shows up in the first 30 pages, she shows up, a man who's going through his own issues. He's got a mother with apparently Alzheimer's living in the house with him because he doesn't want to put her into a home, a wife that he kind of gets along with, a son dealing, I guess, with similar issues that you had at the time. He goes into his attic and he finds Anne Frank. How did that whole idea come about?
Well, there were two things going on. I was writing a character who was espousing the dangers of hope, and that became Solomon, who's the main character, that became his professor, this guy, Professor Job. And I was having fun writing that, letting that theory flower.
The anti-Pangloss.
Yes, yeah, and it was great. It was great, and he surprised me, and it made me laugh a lot. At the same time, there was this character, Solomon, who had moved to a little town in upstate New York to get away from everything, but is terrible at that. So he brings his mother, whom he hates, and whose doctors promised him would be dead within 6 months, but that was 8 months ago, and she's still hanging on. And I was just playing with these ideas of the past and hope, and I had written a horrible, horrible, another doorstop, this should be serious book. And I only liked one idea, one page of the whole thing, which was a family that had been through so many historically bad things that the mother occasionally just shows up in the attic hiding because she's sure genocide is coming. And he, you know, he finds her up there and it's like, Mom, I told you, you know, come on down. And so I started again and didn't like it again. And then realized about halfway through, stop fighting it. It's probably just Anne Frank. It's not the mother. Let's just make it her. And then once that happened and it was like, oh, okay. And so she's up there. She's 83. She's working on her second novel. It's driving her crazy because it's not good. And she's got all this pressure because the first one sold 32 million copies.
It's not a novel, though.
And so she's working really hard on it. And that just started to be a tremendous amount of fun. And so once again, it was like, all right, let's not try and turn this into something it isn't. It is what it is. It's The Shining with Anne Frank.
Did you go back and reread the diary?
Yeah, and I had to do, you know, the thing is, like, some of these things I write about to write my way through. Unfortunately, I end up having to do all this research of a subject I hated. So for Foreskin's Lament, I had to go back and get very familiar with a lot of the mythology and Torah stuff that I'd purposely forgotten. And this one, I found myself, you know, with this idea that made me laugh in a very evil kind of satisfying way. But then I had to go buy the books and books about the people who met her in the camp. And not just those things. I had to also research how it might be possible that she lived. So I needed to read all the survivors' stories, which I found out nobody actually reads. They only read the books about the people who didn't survive, which comes up in the book. And so I had to figure all of that out. But, you know, I came to kind of like her. I was sick of her for most of my life because it was just this face of suffering and death. And you read the book and you read her diary and you're trying to create a character of her later in life. And you realize, well, okay, this was not going to be an easy woman. She was a tough kid. She was very bright. She was very difficult.
And she rewrote a lot of the diary, as it turns out.
Right, and she submitted it for publication. The story I was told was, oh, it was found in a desk afterward. No, it was actually in her lifetime part of it was read on a radio. She just never heard it. She heard a radio program asking for submissions from people under German occupation of what their experience has been like. So she had, like, her A diary and her B diary and C diary. So all that pointed to someone who was not going to be a quiet housewife. There's just no way. And so it became a lot of fun to imagine who this person would be, because she would be a real handful. And as Kugel in the book says a couple of times, she's a little high maintenance.
it also brings up the way the Holocaust has been used over the past 50 years. I think you call it the Misery Olympics. It reminds me a little bit of what we've been dealing with for the past 10 years with 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a similar thing. It's also what goes on in Israel. This is part of who we are as people. It's a question. And I don't know the answer to the question. But what happens is something bad happens, like all of history. And we have to figure out a way to still get up in the morning and not just throw our hands up in the air. So Solomon Kugel's idea is, let me go to a town where nothing ever happened historically. It's famous for nothing happening. And start over. It's a valid theory, probably not very easy to do. His mother's way of dealing with it is to pretend to some degree, or actually come to believe it herself, that she was in the Holocaust, even though she never was. She was born in 1945, the year of cessation, and to be paranoid, to be fearful all the time. And Frank's never more comfortable than when she's in an attic, so she doesn't want to leave. So these are all ways of dealing with all of that stuff. As far as, you know, 9/11 and that stuff goes, look, you know, there's a point in the book where Solomon is angry with his mother because he catches her hiding bread in the couches, which is something she read in a book that survivors did as part of post-traumatic stress, thinking that they were going to have to flee. And he yells at her and says, don't do it. She says, why? He says, because I don't want you to scare Jonah, his son. And her answer is, well, somebody has to. And that's her perspective, is if we're frightened enough, if we keep the terrorist threat level at 5 all the time, then we'll be okay. if we're constantly paranoid, if we have to take off our shoes and belts before we get on a plane, if we're that terrified all the time, that terror is a survival mechanism. It doesn't work, but it certainly helps the economy if you put enough money into defense.
It's also a control mechanism.
Absolutely, yeah.
In the book, it controls her life. It's internal control, but it could just as easily be external control.
Yeah, for her, for the mother, it isn't something she's doing nefariously. She really believes that, you know, she only has one grandson, Solomon's son, and if she doesn't sufficiently terrify him, he might walk unknowingly into an oven one day. Kugel's perspective is, you know what, if we're all going to end up in ovens, then maybe the best thing that could happen is that his son at 35 years of age is getting marched into an oven and he's shocked. He's like, what? Ovens? They put people in ovens? That might be a victory. Let him be flabbergasted. That would be a victory compared to what he was raised with.
Shalom Aslander, in reading the book, his musings are funny. His involvement with Anne Frank is funny. His involvement with town people is funny. His involvement with Joan is very serious. And his involvement with his wife is pretty serious. There's never an attempt to either bring either of them into the humor. How deliberate was that?
Without them, it's just a story of a guy with his pain-in-the-ass mother and Anne Frank. There's no emotional weight to the whole thing. With Jonah and his wife, that's the future. Right? That's his redemption. That's what everything is riding on. They represent that for all of us. In fact, that's what Mother wants to protect so much that she's pretending she was a survivor. Bree's reaction, his wife is named Bree, her reaction to Anne Frank is funny because she's furious and she's like, throw her out. What are you, crazy? And he gets very angry. So there's that level of very real domestic laughter between them, but they're serious because that's what's at risk.
And then he loses his job, and what's going to happen now?
Some of that is modeled on Job. It goes from bad to worse. First he loses his income, then he loses his family, then he loses his health. Those three stages are mimicked in it for nobody's benefit but my own.
Well, why did you decide to use the Job story? Was that always there?
Well, the Job story is always there for me anyway. It was one of the biggest disappointments. It's one of the most disappointing books of my entire life because it starts out exactly where I want to be. You know, God being shown for the heartless, you know, sort of chess piece mover that he really is, taking a character that he loves and putting him through all this. Then the guy loses it. This is a book in the Bible, and he loses it. He's cursing God. He's cursing his friends who curse him for cursing God. It's great. And then right at the end, God comes down, kicks his ass, and says, watch your mouth. And he says, oh, sorry. Who am I to complain? The end. It's the worst ending in history. So for me, there's something about taking that over and over again and messing with it, trying to fix it, maybe.
Shalom Aslander, where do you stand on the whole religious thing now? In your mind, does God exist? Are you an atheist? Are you an agnostic or a new ager?
I'm a doubter. I would love to have one weekend with the certainty, with Richard Dawkins' certainty that nothing is out there. But I just don't like certainty. I came from very certain people. God was certain. His believers were certain. I kind of feel like you're supposed to not know. I just prefer people who doubt everything rather than pick one spot on the chessboard and say, this is where I stay.
It's interesting for me growing up in, well, we went to a conservative temple, but our brains were reformed. To me, when I'd go to temple, it never seemed as if it was something that you couldn't doubt.
You know, the other weird thing is that the father of the religion, so to say, Abraham, was a doubter. The first story I was ever taught about him, before he lost his mind and tried to kill his son, was that he, as a little kid, his father was a non-believer, because God had yet to appear, and he had an idol store, and he prayed to these idols. And little Abe walked in one day when his father wasn't there and was so full of doubt and so full of questioning about these gods that he took a hammer to them all, smashed them all to bits. His father comes in, grabs him, says, what are you doing? You've just angered the gods. And he says, well, if they're such gods, why couldn't they defend themselves? Great story. And it's a story that the rabbis love to tell you because it's mocking other gods. But never again are you supposed to have that level of doubt about your own gods. It's so backwards. How can the founder of the whole thing be this model of questioning? And he arose in the morning and left. That's the start of the third chapter. He's gone. He walked away. But now if you walk away, you're a heretic or you're a heathen or you're something worse.
Do you think Solomon Kugel, when I hear that, I just keep thinking about bakeries. I don't know why.
Well, the name came from an article I saw ages ago, before I was even working on the book, in the New York Times, like food section. And it was about the noodle pudding, and the headline was Unraveling Kugel. And I thought, well, that almost sounds like a postmodern Jewish Beckett. Kugel Unravels, you know, and one of those books that starts bad and gets worse. And I just decided I liked that name as a name.
There was an early Woody Allen story called the Kugelmas episode.
Right, so, yeah.
Some of those names in Yiddish are pretty funny anyway.
Well, my name's pretty ridiculous, so I like ridiculous names.
When you got outside of the shtetl, how do people react when you say your name's Shalom?
Well, first I lied, and I picked, like, you know, the most goyish-sounding names I could pick, which all felt stupid to me. And so I gave up on it, and it wasn't too bad because I was using it in New York City, and it was the early days of, like, when Run DMC was just sort of getting out there, and the Beastie Boys, and a lot of different cultures were actually starting to talk to each other. And everyone thought it was a really cool name because it meant I was politically aware, because I was so into peace. And now I live in Woodstock, and it's just, you know, it's peace everywhere, and I don't even associate my name with that anymore.
What is Tablet?
Tablet is a website, Jewish interest culture website, that allows me to write pretty much anything once a month, and just have some fun trying out different things. And they were originally called Next Book. I think that there still is an organization of that, but it's tabletmag.com, and it's fun. I get to rant and rave. I rant about my publisher and everything around me, and it's a good outlet.
When we received this book, there was a long rant about the different titles for the book. That Hope a Tragedy was your original title, but no one liked it. And people kept suggesting, were those real titles in that little segment that you...
Yeah. I liked Hope a Tragedy right away. The people around me that I share these things with liked it. My publisher didn't. You know, you get into that conversation. It's like, oh, yeah, no, the book's good, but let's talk titles. And it's like, oh, God, it's the worst conversation to have.
You must have had it for Foreskin's Lament as well.
Well, Foreskin's Lament I sent in because I knew that that title was going to come up. The note was, that's the title, and I'm not changing it. I kind of knew that with this, too, but then it was like, okay, so what other titles were there? There was, you know, that sort of working title that I never intended to be was The Diary of Anne Frankenstein. And it was like a thing to write up on the wall and remind me of what I was shooting for. I always liked, because Kugel wants to be nowhere. That's his dream. And I liked the title Nowhere Ho, like Westward Ho. And that was going to be the title for a little while. And then my publisher started asking around, and nobody under 30 had any clue what that was a reference to. I think they thought home was like a hooker, and they didn't know what had to do with anything. And so we ended up making our way all the way back.
You wrote an introduction to a book I've never heard of called The Eternal Philistine, published by Melville House. It's online. It's a very long introduction. How did that come about, and what's the story with that book?
I had met Dennis, who's from Melville House, and we talked. He came to a reading and said, I have this book that went out of print, and we're going to redo it, and it's really dark, and I think you'd like it. And I read it, and I loved it. And the guy's story, his own story, is so dark. And it's one of these very European tales of writing and running and writing and running and spending his whole life with this irrational fear of trees and then dying when a tree branch fell on him. But the book has that kind of humor. And so I found it amazing that it reflected his entire fate. But it's a really funny book, really dark, about some people traveling to a world's fair. And how badly it goes. You know, during the war, so there's anti-Semitism and there's German hypocrisy, but all done in a very, very funny, dark way.
You also took a branding class for GQ.
Well, I took it for myself, but it turned into an article for GQ. Yeah, it was this kind of like, I saw it and I thought, I've got to hear what they have to say. And maybe maybe I can use a change. Maybe, you know, everybody was sort of starting to associate me in my social world as kind of a downer and a bummer, and I didn't want my kids to feel that way. So I thought maybe I just need to rebrand myself, maybe a snappy new logo, and, you know, just thinking myself in a different way. And so they had this online branding course, and I ended up being even more upset after taking it, because I couldn't believe people were doing this seriously, like talking about themselves as a brand. Well, I'm the guy who's always friendly, but you know, if you need a shoulder, I'm there. I'm the guy who's a great listener. That's my brand. So I need to sell that a little bit better. I don't think people know that about me. And you're just like, what have we done? What have we become? It was bad enough when we had commercials. Now we're actually them. We've become them.
Shalom Auslander, how many of those doorstops, those unhappy doorstops, sit in your on your computer, hard drive?
You know what? Having realized that I don't even like reading those things, let alone writing them, what I have now is I have a bunch of stuff that I can go through and just redress and go, well, you know what? I still like that thought. That thought came from somewhere deep inside me. I just looked at it the wrong way. I was looking at it through the wrong lens, colored lenses. I was looking at it through literary lenses, which, I don't love a lot of what Bukowski wrote, but he has one great section in Post Office where he's talking about Camus and The Stranger and saying how much the character loved that book because it just spoke to him about that sort of the emotionlessness, the numbness. But he couldn't get past how beautifully well it was written. That felt like a lie, that it felt like he must have not really felt it if he could do that to it. And I love that thought. I kind of feel like I'm not the prose lives for literature thing. I love ideas, and I love humor, and I love laughing at the darkness, and I love what books can do. I don't love, as I said earlier, I don't love the religion.
And that includes the writing religion.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I mean. I don't like, I just think it hurts it. It's not just a question of do I like it. I think it hurts it. I think it takes something, any of these books can be about something amazing and wonderful. And to me, bookstores were, because of the world I was in as a kid and still are and should be, dangerous places. You're never going to get a TV show that even gets close to what the most lame book says, because they're radical and they should be. But when you start to polish them too much, they just become little glass animals that you put on a shelf. It's not anything real.
I noticed something on your website that I'm actually going to put the link on my website, which is that a lot of writers on their website, they link to Amazon, they link to Barnes & Noble. You give links to those in case people want to go there, but you also give a link to a place that tells you where the indie stores in your area are.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important.
I saw that about a year or so ago. I think it's fantastic that they do that. I actually didn't even know that you could, that there's an indie reader for ebooks as well. They can download it through a bookstore. And my understanding is they're coming back somewhat. Now that the monsters are all eating each other. But there was a point in Woodstock where the local bookstore, the Golden Notebook, was about to close. And it was just, I was like, I'm going to have to move. I can't raise my kids in a town without a bookstore. That's horrifying. And fortunately, a friend of ours actually took it over, and it's doing well.
Shalom Auslander, Hope a Tragedy has now come out. You're working on another novel, another collection, another memoir?
Yes and no.
How did you get involved with This American Life?
When you write a book and you want to publish it, you have to become a whore to some degree. And you have to do whatever you can to sell. You're in a selling mode. So I wrote Beware of God. I didn't intend on it even getting published. It was the last thing I thought would happen. And my editor was bringing it out. He said, look, there's like 10 people in America who read, and they all listen to this radio show. So let's try and get you on there. But they don't. The book was fiction, and they do nonfiction primarily. So is there something you can write about? The stories in Beware of God are about God and Judaism. Very weird, but about that roughly. So I thought, oh, you know what? I'll write this story about in school, instead of having spelling bees, we had blessing bees. You had to line up, and they throw a food at you, and you have to tell them which blessing it is. And then about a week later, Ira phoned, and that was the first thing I did, and just started doing stuff together after that. And it's great. It's a lot of fun. They're very tough with making sure the stuff works, but it's actually kind of like served as something of a workshop for Foreskin's Lament.
And what's the next novel?
You know, I've found that the less I talk about them, the more likely I am to write them.
How far are you?
I'm close to sending something to my publisher, who will probably hate it and tell me, you know, go rest up from the tour because your brain's not working well. But it makes me laugh in the same dark way. It makes me feel like there's a lot of alarm saying you're not supposed to say that, which tells me that I probably should be.
You've been listening to an interview with Shalom Auslander, whose latest book is titled Hope, a Tragedy, a Novel. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.